Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline across the top of the page, Novak retiring, Cisco taps paradise again. And this article runs horizontally across the top of the page. On the far left, there's a picture of a man standing with some electronics equipment behind him. He's dressed casually. The caption reads, Ed Paradise is a Cisco Systems veteran. This article was written by Monica Chen with the Dateline of Morrisville. Big changes are underway at the 4,900-worker Cisco Systems operations in the Triangle. Not only is the San Jose, California-based networking company cutting 170 full-time workers here, a big change in the company's Triangle leadership is in the works. The head of Cisco's RTP operations, site executive Joe Novak, is retiring. Ed Paradise, who had been site executive at RTP from 2003 to 2009 before Novak, will resume the top spot. Triangle Business Journal obtained copies of emails from Novak and Paradise that were sent to Cisco RTP employees on July 25 and August 4, respectively. On July 25, Novak wrote, The decision was mine and a very difficult one because it involves leaving an extraordinary group of friends and colleagues and a remarkable company with a very bright future ahead. Paradise wrote on August 4, This is a difficult time in Cisco's history and for many of us personally. I join Cisco's leadership team in thanking you for your patience and perseverance as we transition to the new Cisco. Novak's last day at Cisco was August 15. Contractors will receive notifications throughout this current quarter, which is the first quarter of Cisco's fiscal year 2012. The RTP job reductions are part of the company's global mandate to cut $1 billion from operating expenses, which means cutting 6,500 workers, including 1,200 contractors, and 17% of executive officers. Novak became the site executive for RTP in October 2009. He was one of the original employees to start Cisco's operations in the Triangle 18 years ago. Paradise was not available for comment this week, but a Cisco spokeswoman released a statement. Joe has been an invaluable contributor and leaves Cisco with a strong track record of leadership and results in the business and community. He will be greatly missed, and we wish him well on his future endeavors. Cisco RTP is the company's second largest location in the U.S. behind San Jose and the third largest globally. Cisco reported positive fourth quarter fiscal year 2011 earnings on August 10, beating Wall Street expectations. Total revenue was $11.2 billion for the quarter, up 3.3% year over year. Profit was $1.2 billion, down 39.3% year over year. The company's stock rallied with a 16% increase the next day. However, the conventional wisdom among tech watchers and analysts is that the company's innovation has stalled as a result of an increasingly bureaucratic corporate culture. CEO John Chambers has been criticized for his management structure, as reported by the Wall Street Journal, that set up a top-down structure with 12 councils and 47 boards. Such practices mired the company in a decision-making by consensus and innovation by consensus process, tech industry experts believe. Mark Su, an analyst with RBC Capital Markets, wrote in a report after Cisco's fourth quarter earnings that the stock is still not investable. Cisco is doing many things operationally, such as reducing its headcount and streamlining processes, but there are disruptions in the business, which Cisco is starting to concede, Su wrote. The company, which made networking routers its bread and butter in its early years, in recent years ventured into consumer products such as the flip camera business and a home energy management console business. Both have been shuttered in the company's cutbacks. Cisco had partnered with Duke Energy to pilot the energy management dashboards. Locally, tech industry experts hold an optimistic view of Cisco. Robbie Allen, founder of Durham-based sports data startup Starsheet and a former IT engineer at Cisco, says the problem the company has faced is mostly the result of its growth and size. The problem is that when a company gets the size of Cisco, you can only move so fast, Allen says. The product delivery cycles are so elongated because of all the people and process, it hurts time to market. This is a common problem that all companies have when they reach a certain size. They stop innovating, says Vivek Wadhwa, a Duke University professor and entrepreneur. Cisco used to acquire startups to keep its innovation engine humming, but this seems to have slowed down. Overall, I'm still optimistic about the company. This is a wake-up call. And our next article is in the center of the page, on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. It has a black border around it. Inside that border, taking up the right half is a picture of a man wearing a tie, holding some papers in his hand. He has glasses, a beard. The caption reads, David Hartzell advises students in investing program. And then on the left side, there's the article headline in bold black print, Investors Ante Up for Student Picks at UNC Chapel Hill. With $2.1 million vested, Keenan Flagler funds raising $3.5 million. And this article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with a dateline of Chapel Hill. A group of students at UNC in Chapel Hill are raising money, and lots of it. $3.5 million, in fact, and that's on top of $2.1 million raised in 2007. No, they're not planning the university's biggest frat party. They're investing it into real estate. It's a real-world investment fund managed by students in the Keenan Flagler Business School called KFBSF, Keenan Flagler Business School Fund. Launched 4 years ago to help students learn how to spot real estate deals while managing real money. All of the original $2.1 million in KFBSF Real Estate Fund 1 is vested. The current $3.5 million fundraiser was revealed in U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission documents filed August 12, stating that KFBSF Real Estate Fund 2 had already secured nearly $1.5 million in commitments from 19 investors. All of the Fund 2 investors, as was the case in the first fund, are either graduates of the university or business leaders affiliated with the business school, says fund faculty advisor David Hartzell, a professor of real estate and of finance at the school. And while the primary goal of the program is to enhance the education of MBA students who are planning careers in real estate, Hartzell says investors still expect a return on their money. A lot of these investors are really experienced in real estate, and they will grill our students, Hartzell says. If they see something that doesn't look right, they will go after them, which I think is great. It's the best real-world opportunity for these students. School officials say Keenan Flagler is the only business school in the nation to offer such a program. Lewis Stoneburner Jr., a second-year MBA student from Richmond, Virginia, who joined the fund management team in February, says most of the students involved in the fund already have experience working in real estate and plan to pursue careers in the industry when they graduate. We take this very seriously, he says. I've had multiple face-to-face pitches where I get grilled for an hour, but part of the learning experience is getting in front of people, getting challenged, and being able to talk intelligently about it. The student fund management team is in charge of contacting potential investors, choosing where to invest the fund's money, tracking the cash flow of each property, and reporting their results back to the investors. Fund 1's portfolio includes a mix of apartment, office, retail, and development sites in New Jersey, Virginia, Georgia, Florida, and Texas. Fund 2 is expected to have a similar mix of property types. Hartzell says the first fund included new apartment development projects in Orlando and in San Antonio that have generated good returns. The fund also has investments in 3 distressed residential neighborhoods in the Washington, D.C. and Miami areas. The fund has not yet sold any of the properties in the portfolio, but Hartzell says its managers have made distribution payments to investors, although he would not disclose how much money has been distributed nor the rate of return so far. We started out wanting to do development deals, but given the uncertainty of valuations, we took it slowly, Hartzell says. We let the students do their own due diligence and try to make it as realistic as we possibly can for our students. Leonard Wood, Jr., director of development company Wood Partners Mid-Atlantic Region, says no such real-world program was available to him when he was going through Keenan Flagler's MBA program in 2003. So he says he was glad to be able to participate in the newest fund. It's an excellent way for the alumni to get involved and invest back into the program, he says. Wood's father, veteran real estate executive Leonard Wood, Sr., also is an investor and member of the fund's board of directors. An advisory board led by Hartzell and Deborah Anderson, executive director of the Keenan Institute Center for Real Estate Development, work with the student fund managers on a weekly basis, and the foundation board gives final approval for all deals made from the fund. About 35 students have cycled through the program so far, and between 7 and 10 students are involved with the fund at any point throughout the year. MBA candidate Churchill Bunn of Wilson was selected as the fund manager in early summer and says he spends about 10 to 15 hours a week working on the fund. The only compensation fund managers receive is one class credit each quarter. You get 6 or 7 classes in real estate plus some electives when you're here, but the fund is the capstone opportunity to get real-world experience, Bunn says. Having come from a brokerage background, I had a good feel for real estate but had never looked at it from an institutional investment perspective quite like I do now. And now we move to the bottom of the front page. And this article runs horizontally across the bottom of the page. The headline, Duke setting up MBA program for university in Kazakhstan. And this article on the far left has a picture of the outside of a building. With the building is mostly glass, multiple stories, very nice looking building. The caption reads, one of the buildings at Nazarbayev University in Kazakhstan. And this article was written by Jason DeBrun with a Dateline of Durham. Continuing its globalization strategy, Duke University will help Nazarbayev University in Kazakhstan start an MBA program. Degrees will bear the Nazarbayev University name, not that of Duke. Other Western universities, including the University of Pennsylvania and University College of London, are helping other departments get off the ground at the university, which bears the name of Kazakhstan President Nursultan Nazarbayev. Duke's Fuqua School of Business was chosen to build the Master of Business Administration after Nazarbayev University officials asked for a proposal and Duke made what was deemed to be the best offer. The goal is to design, initially staff, and build the MBA program until leaders at Nazarbayev can take it over, says Jennifer Francis, Duke's Senior Associate Dean for Programs, and Valerie Hossman, Assistant Dean for Global Business Development at Duke. Duke has existing partnerships throughout the world, and global leaders met the Kazakhstan Minister of Education during a trip to St. Petersburg, Russia, where they explored a partnership. Fuqua did its first assessment in early 2010 and agreed to an initial contract that runs through August 1, 2012, just before the first MBA classes begin, Hossman says. The administration is working on a contract to stay with Nazarbayev U, though the first three to five years of classes as well. Duke will not require any professors to go overseas, but when students start taking classes, Fuqua professors likely will be teaching. I think that there are a number of faculty who would find this an interesting opportunity, says Francis, reiterating that students would earn a Nazarbayev U degree. It is their degree, she says. Duke's involvement in Nazarbayev U makes sense to Alan Ruby, a senior fellow at the University of Pennsylvania Graduate School of Education. There has been a sort of general trend across Western universities to become international, he says. That can happen in one of two ways. Either a university can have international students, faculty, and researchers come to the United States, or by having relationships with other universities, as in this case, the push to become international is very high, very strong, and much stronger than it has been for many years, he says. The trend will continue, he says. There currently are roughly 145 Western University branch campuses around the world, and some 3 million students will study outside their country of citizenship. That number will grow to 6 million or 7 million students by 2030, Ruby predicts. Duke did not release financial terms of the agreement with Nazarbayev U, and Ruby declined to guess. He said revenue might have played a small role in the decision to establish the partnership, but it was more shaped by the desire to do good by creating better educational institutions, he says. You can do this to make money, and people do, but I don't think that's the motivating factor for Duke, he says. The best outcome for Duke is to continue becoming a true global player, he says, a strategy that other followers of higher education have noticed. Clearly, their president has talked pretty vocally about the need to focus globally, says Ian Wilhelm, an associate global editor for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Duke's Office of Global Strategy and Programs already has partnerships around the world, and University President Richard Broadhead has touted Duke's global reach and influence. Duke's commitment to education, research, and service around the globe is a hallmark of this great university, said Michael H. Merson when he took over as interim vice provost for global strategy and programs in June. Through its partnership in Kazakhstan, Duke will help start only the MBA program. Elsewhere, Kunshan, China, being a prime example, Duke is actually building a satellite campus and will offer Duke degrees. Some Duke professors have expressed concern about the demand for such a venture. And we have one last article on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. This runs vertically along the right side of the page. The headline, State Revenue Rebound Not Seen Until 2014. And this article is written by Lee Weisbecker with a Dateline of Raleigh. Revenue from taxes collected by the state are not projected to return to the peak level of 2008 until fiscal year 2014. That is what North Carolina forecasters told the Washington, D.C.-based National Conference of State Legislators in response to a recent survey aimed at gauging whether the states are finally turning the corner on the Great Recession. North Carolina was one of 10 states forecasting that a full collection rebound, the key to closing the massive budget gaps that have plagued the state, won't happen until the fiscal year ending June 30, 2014. And at this point, I think that remains a reasonable and conservative estimate, says Barry Boardman, an economist and fiscal researcher with the North Carolina General Assembly. In looking at recent employment growth and other factors, Boardman says he is left wondering where any accelerated growth is going to come from. That's why I think we won't rebound before 2013 to 2014, he says. I could be wrong. In peak year, fiscal 2008, the state collected $18.8 billion in total taxes, including so-called economy-based levies, payroll withholding, sales, and corporate income. In 2009, the worst year of the downturn, the total take fell to $16.7 billion. In 2010, it climbed back to $17.7 billion and recovered to $18.3 billion for the 12 months ending June 30. But that $18.3 billion, up 3.6% over the prior year, was reached in part due to temporary sales and income tax increases that have been allowed to sunset. The nine states, besides North Carolina, telling NCSL they don't expect a tax recovery until the fiscal 2014 time period, are Texas, Florida, Georgia, Idaho, Illinois, Missouri, Massachusetts, Colorado, and Connecticut. Three times a year, NCSL asks the states to report on their tax collections and budget outlooks. The organization's next survey is due out in early September and is expected to show that most states, North Carolina included, foresee modest tax growth in 2011 to 2012. The group also thinks that the combined budget gap faced by the states will shrink from $96 billion in 2011 to $12.3 billion by 2014. North Carolina's gap during the past budget season was $2.58 billion. States are trending towards more optimism that the worst may be over and revenue is growing, says NCSL's Megan Dorsch, who adds, however, that the sample was taken before the recent volatility on Wall Street. Predictions of modest revenue growth at the state level dovetail with the best available estimates of how North Carolina's economy will perform in the second half of 2011 and into 2012. UNC Charlotte economist John Connaughton says North Carolina's gross state product, at $402 billion at the close of 2010, will grow by 1.9% in the third quarter of this year and 2.7% in the fourth. For 2012, he says, the GSP will hit $427 billion, up by 2.3% over 2011. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column. The headline that starts it off, Wake Tech Buys Land for Future in North Raleigh. And under that, there's a picture of a room full of young people sitting on computers in what looks to be a computer lab. Actually, the caption reads, Wake Tech's classes are in high demand. The trustees at Wake Technical Community College are using part of savings from lower-than-expected bids on campus construction projects over the past couple of years to buy 10 acres of land adjacent to the college's North Raleigh campus on Lewisburg Road. Wake Tech paid $1 million to New York finance firm Rosenthal & Rosenthal Incorporated, which acquired the property through a January 2010 foreclosure. The lot, most of which has already been cleared of trees, will initially be used as an overflow parking lot for faculty, staff, and students, says Wake Tech spokeswoman Lori Clowers. The property could later accommodate more buildings, but the college still has plenty of room to grow. Wake Tech so far has built on 47 of its 127 acres of North Raleigh land, and it has plans for 7 additional academic buildings, a visitor center and 4 parking decks. Construction of its Building E classroom and auditorium is expected to be complete in the spring, and construction of a parking deck will begin in September. Wake Tech has earmarked all of its remaining funds from a 2007 bond referendum, and Clower says the college may look at putting another construction bond referendum on the vote ballot in 2012. Riverside High School in Durham is getting a renovation of its athletic weight room thanks to the Carolina Panthers. That's because football coach David Hackney took the time to apply for a $25,000 grant offered by the Panthers. It's needed. The weight room was built 20 years ago, and some of the equipment is that old. "We're in desperate need of some new equipment," Hackney told the Herald Sun of Durham. "We've gotten by with donated equipment from colleges when they've upgraded their weight rooms." Hotel Indigo, which operates a hotel near Research Triangle Park, has been ranked highest in guest satisfaction among upscale hotel chains by the J.D. Power & Associates 2011 North American Hotel Guest Satisfaction Index study. Hotel Indigo opened in RTP in August 2009. To earn the top satisfaction ranking, Hotel Indigo outperformed all other upscale hotel chains in the study, scoring highest in overall guest satisfaction as determined by 7 key measures: reservations, check-in, check-out, guest room, food and beverage, hotel services, hotel facilities, and cost and fees. The hotel is located off Miami Boulevard in Durham. Competitors in the upscale classification include Courtyard by Marriott, Radisson, and Four Points by Sheraton. Chemical sales firm Doe and Ingalls is getting ready to break ground on a warehouse building in Durham that will allow the company to more than triple the inventory it carries for its manufacturing and life sciences clients across the East Coast. John Hollenbeck, president and CEO of Doe and Ingalls, says the company searched around for an existing warehouse building in Durham, but the safety features the company requires mandated that a new facility be built. The company recently bought 7.7 acres near Miami Boulevard, where construction of a 50,000-square-foot facility has started, he says. Once completed, Doe and Ingalls will vacate the 35,000-square-foot facility it occupied on Person Street in Durham for more than 2 decades and lease the space to a couple of its clients. About 40 of the company's 90 employees are based in Durham, and Hollenbeck says he's expecting to create more jobs in Durham this year for sales and quality control associates as growth demands. Brittany Wilson is accustomed to making people look stylish in her job as master designer at the BLO hairstyle shop in Raleigh. Indeed, she's paid to do just that. But a recent gig in Virginia had her making folks look dirty, malnourished, and tired. "I used a heavy deep conditioner in the hair to make it look like it hadn't been washed, and gray eyeshadow to counteract the natural pink pigment on cheeks," she says. "I'm used to going into work every day to make people look their attractive best, but these characters had to look really worn out." She was working on the set of a movie being produced with the help of grants and donations that tells the story of child abuse and neglect in the Appalachian Mountains. The producers, Happy Tree Films and Real Life Productions, want to bring attention to the issues of poverty and child abuse with the movie titled The Story of Tammy Joe. "Participating in this film was eye-opening in that I learned facts about child abuse," says Wilson. 5 children die each day related to abuse and neglect. The story of Tammy Joe is expected to be completed in September and will be entered into film festivals such as Sundance, Tribeca, Telluride, and South by Southwest. Franklin Regional Medical Center and its Magnetic Resonance Imaging, or MRI, service has had its national accreditation from the American College of Radiology renewed. "We are thrilled to receive this national recognition," Diane Gibbs, manager of Franklin Regional's radiology department, said in a statement. The Daily Beast calls them the nation's most popular beaches because the list is based on the number of people who show up on these strands each year. Biz calls them a shopping list of beaches to avoid. The list was compiled by researching the attendance at each beach in a season and then considering the resident population of the beach. The only North Carolina beach to make the list is Nag's Head, which has a resident population of 3,058 but had 916,375 visitors in 2010, according to the Daily Beast. Finishing at number 4 was Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, 4.5 million visitors in 2010 and a resident population of 16,221. Amazingly, Jacksonville Beach, Florida attracted twice the number of visitors in 2010, as did Myrtle Beach, 9 million, to finish at number 1 on the list. Jacksonville Beach has a population of 22,051. So that's the place to really avoid. You might think of baby monitors only for babies, but Biz knows they can be used for other purposes. Hospice of Wake County is collecting new or gently used safety, think baby, monitors they will put in patients' homes so they can effectively communicate needs to those in other rooms. As patients decline, they are not as able to protect their voices, says Meredith Barrett, a hospice program facilitator. Baby monitors are an effective tool for reducing falls, as they allow caregivers to hear their loved one if they have stepped into another room. The ability for caregivers to take a personal moment, knowing they will be able to hear their loved one, can help to reduce caregivers' overall stress level. Monetary donations for batteries are also being accepted at the agency's administrative office at 250 Hospice Circle, just off Trinity Road in Raleigh. The Friends of North Carolina, a nonprofit group that supports corporate recruiting, held the first of 4 signature events planned over the next 12 months in Atlanta on August 2 to attract attention to the state among site selection consultants from across the country. The FONC sponsored a reception and party at the Wimbish House that attracted more than 100 consultants and consular officers and developers, as well as key commerce officials, including North Carolina Commerce Secretary Keith Crisco. Raleigh Bluegrass Band Old Habits provided entertainment. Future events for site selection consultants are planned in New York in November, in Dallas, Texas in March 2012, and an Experience North Carolina Familiarization Tour in Asheville on May 6th through 8th, 2012. Prestonwood Country Club in Cary has opened a golf learning center, a 2,500-square-foot building that includes indoor and outdoor practice bays, a swing analysis video system, an indoor putting studio, and other such goodies to slice and dice a duffer's game. The condominium residences at The Landing at South Point in Durham will be sold at auction on August 21. 10 of the 33 units will be sold absolute, meaning they will be sold to the highest bidder regardless of the price. Most of the units have been selling for between $175,000 and $315,000. Paragon Commercial Bank of Raleigh will even be offering financing options for buyers and investors. Contributing to Biz were staffers Amanda Jones-Hoyle, Monica Chen, and Jason DeBrun. And now we return to the full-length articles in the Triangle Business Journal. And we come to an article on page 3. This one's in the center of the page, has a black border around it. Inside the border at the top, there are two women dressed professionally sitting at a desk discussing something. The caption reads, "Dr. Samantha Meltzer Brody and Eileen Spall believe the new unit will help ease the suffering of many women." And then under that, there's the headline in bold black lettering, followed by the article. The headline, "Help for Postpartum. UNC Chapel Hill Sets Aside Beds for Pregnant Women, New Moms with Depression." And this article was written by Jason DeBrun with a dateline of Chapel Hill. When University of North Carolina Healthcare opened its new Center for Postpartum Depression on August 15, it opened something that pregnant women or new mothers struggling with depression cannot find anywhere else. The department, officially called the Center for Women's Mood Disorders, treats depression in women at all stages of pregnancy and early motherhood. It was first envisioned about 3 years ago, at a time when these patients were treated in the same area as other psychiatric patients, including men with severe mental illnesses or drug and alcohol addictions. In a general psychiatry floor, you have people who battle a wide range of mental disorders, says Dr. Samantha Meltzer Brody, director of the Perinatal Mood and Anxiety Disorder Program at UNC Healthcare, which is not always suitable for a woman with an infant, she says. UNC hospitals opened an outpatient clinic for women battling perinatal depression in 2004 and began an inpatient program in 2008 by taking over some beds from the geriatric psychiatric wing. That was better, but many geriatric patients suffered from dementia, and that location still was not ideal, Meltzer Brody says. That's when UNC decided to separate a portion of the hospital and designate psychiatric care for pregnant women or new mothers. About half of all new mothers experience some range of the baby blues, according to the Mayo Clinic, and about 15% suffer from true depression. Many can be treated in an outpatient setting, but about 5% of those cases require the more acute setting of an inpatient facility. The hospital took three of its psychiatric beds and moved them into a secluded wing and have two more beds that can go either to the new center or back to general psychiatry. Because UNC Healthcare had the doctors, nurses, space, and beds, given that the types of treatments do not require expensive equipment, the entire renovation project cost only $80,000. Doctors around the state have taken notice. I was thrilled that the hospital was starting a unit for women who are having depression, says Dr. D. Elizabeth Jesse, a professor at East Carolina University College of Nursing, who was just awarded a $640,000 grant from the National Institute of Mental Health to develop a program to prevent perinatal depression for low-income women. Nearly all patients who suffer from depression or mental disorders are stigmatized, Jesse says, but it seems even more pronounced in pregnant women or new mothers. Women think they should be happy, but it isn't always a happy time of life, she says, but that's something that people don't want to say. She hopes the center devoted to those patients will help destigmatize the condition and help women recover faster and more completely. I think it would reduce the fear greatly, she says, adding that the center could allow for special care like breastfeeding and newborn visits that would be difficult in a general psychiatric wing. Researchers found that screening and early detection for postpartum depression can have profound positive effects. But left untreated, postpartum depression can have severe negative effects on a mother's health and well-being, her relationships with family members, the baby's subsequent cognitive, behavioral, and emotional development, and greater long-term health care and social costs, according to a research article published in the February 2011 Health Affairs Journal by doctors and researchers from Harvard Medical School, the University of Minnesota, and the Kaiser Permanente Division of Research. To Meltzer Brody, that was the best part of the center. This can be treated. People can get better, she says, hoping the center will go a long way in providing that care. The bottom line? Is people don't have to suffer, she says. Law grad jobs market dismal. That's the headline on our next story. This one written by Chris Bagley with the Dateline of Durham. Triangle Law School graduates are having a hard time finding a job, and some who do are making less pay than they'd like or positions they'd rather not have. The truth is in the numbers from a survey by the National Association of Legal Professionals. At UNC Chapel Hill, 94% of 2010 graduates were working 9 months after graduation, down from 96% the year prior. At Campbell University, the rate fell from 92% to 84% year over year. Even at Duke University, where the 2009 rate was 100%, the 2010 class fell short at 99%. At NC Central University, the rate actually rose from 85% to 88%, but Assistant Dean Linda Wendling says the gain reflects improved data collection and not necessarily better prospects for graduates. This is the worst downturn that anyone alive today has seen, but in every downturn there are job openings, and those openings are going to people who are the best prepared, says Brian Lewis, Career Services Director at UNC Chapel Hill's Law School. The NALP numbers, first released in June and updated by schools in recent weeks, show more students taking jobs in public service, a category that includes district attorney's offices, legal foundations, and federal regulatory agencies. Attorneys' starting salaries vary enormously, particularly among private law firms, but pay in that sector is typically 30% to 80% of what private firms pay. Law firms laid off attorneys en masse following the financial crisis of 2008, something that few in the profession could remember. Hiring began to pick up last year, but law firm managers say experienced attorneys hold a significant advantage over recent graduates. It's a grim picture for those graduates. Using historical and projected data from dozens of federal and state agencies, one forecasting firm estimated in June that the nation's law schools are churning out 70% more graduates than the legal market can support. Even Duke grads appear to be feeling the pinch. About 10% of Duke's 2009 and 2010 class is working in jobs that don't require a law license, up from 3% or less in prior years. Five of the 220-plus Duke graduates from each of the last 2 years are pursuing advanced degrees. Law schools generally praise that pursuit, but the numbers are notably higher from an annual average of just one graduate in prior years. Numbers of graduates not seeking employment, which aren't used to calculate schools' percentages, are also up slightly at Duke and other schools. Duke and UNC both sent fewer graduates to private law firms in the last 2 years. Among Blue Devils with jobs, the percentage in private practice fell to 61% last year, from 70% in 2009 and 75% in 2008. At Carolina, the percentage fell to 46% from 55%. Economic Modeling Specialists Incorporated, a Moscow, Idaho forecasting firm that compared law grads with available jobs, found that North Carolina has the 15th widest gap between 2009 law grads and available jobs for attorneys. EMSI analyst Josh Wright says the state's high concentration of law schools isn't necessarily a bad thing if graduates find jobs out of state. Based on the numbers of people passing state bar exams, which correlate more closely with graduates' career plans, North Carolina's situation is only the nation's 19th worst. Still, Wright says the recession seems to have pushed a wave of students into graduate schools, even into law schools, where graduates commonly exit with $100,000 to $200,000 in debt, along with a diploma. The momentum is building to where there are just so many students, Wright says. CAT, Rex, others get help as NCSU students get educated. That's the headline on our next article. And this article has a picture above it of two young women casually dressed, wearing safety glasses, going over some paperwork, holding some items. The caption reads, Suzanne Sawyer and Ivy Starr are among students in NCSU program with industry. And this article is written by Jason DeBrun with a Dateline of Raleigh. North Carolina State University students will streamline production at Caterpillar, Rex, and Ingersoll Rand this semester. Graduating seniors from the Edward P. Fitz Department of Industrial and Systems Engineering must complete a team design project to solve real-life inefficiencies for companies in and around the Triangle. Projects are set up almost like mini internships that give students a sense of how projects are managed from start to finish, says Anita Villa Parrish, the department's director of undergraduate programs. While the relationships built in the industry foster more projects, they also help students get plugged in professionally after graduation. Last year, for example, two students found postgraduate internships with the companies with which they worked on their senior project, Villa Parrish says. The benefits go both ways. The company partners do not pay the university and essentially receive free consulting work while students earn real-life experiences in problem-solving. The university accepts donations to a fund that helps pay for student necessities such as steel-toed boots or travel expenses. We have been very fortunate to work with our backdoor neighbors here in Raleigh, says Chad Lefteris, Rex Healthcare Vice President of Support Services. At Rex, teams will analyze how the hospital deals with various patient populations. Patients fall into specific categories based on the reason for admission and go through various tests or procedures based on that classification. What Rex wants to find out, says Lefteris, is how to make those steps more efficient. If a patient must go across the hospital to have a blood sample drawn, only to return to where she or he were for a different test, that would be an inefficiency the hospital wants to fix, Lefteris says, giving only a hypothetical situation. At the Caterpillar Fabrications Plant in Sanford, students will look for ways to improve material flow. Steel frames for heavy pieces of equipment are built at the plant. Large pieces of cut and bent steel are delivered to the factory, where they are welded together for the frame of a machine called a skid steer loader, which is sort of like a small loader with rubber tracks and a bucket that can be interchanged with other work tools such as forks. Work can be improved in two areas, says Martin Kegel, a fabrications operations manager at the Caterpillar plant. He wants to improve how materials flow through the 9,000-square-foot facility and how work gets done while in the weld cells. The pieces assemble in a certain order, but they are not necessarily coming into the building in that order, says Kegel. For him, the question is, how do we get it in the building and get it distributed? At Ingersoll Rand in Southern Pines, the plant has gone through a radical transformation in the past 2 years, says Dustin Bonecutter, the human resources manager. The company will have expanded from about 100 employees at the end of 2009 to 334 by the end of August. The goals are similar to those at Caterpillar: get product in the door and to the proper workstation more efficiently. Specifically, Ingersoll Rand makes heavy grinders to smooth joints that have been welded, such as those on large ships. Because of all the added business and new workers, however, sometimes the parts do not get to the right place in the most direct way. And our next article, written by Lee Weisbecker with the Dateline of Raleigh, has a headline, First Citizens Owns Colorado Bank It Bought, Or Does It? And with this article, there's a picture of two men. One's in a suit and tie. One's casually dressed. They're standing outside of a building. The caption reads, Jim Peoples, former CEO, and Guy Gibson, former chairman, are challenging bank's takeover. A federal judge has kept alive a lawsuit that throws Raleigh-based First Citizens Bank's takeover of a failed Denver, Colorado bank into uncertainty. Judge Amy Berman Jackson of the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia has declined to dismiss a complaint brought by former directors and executives of United Western Bank against the Office of Thrift Supervision, the federal regulator that led the way in taking control of the bank in January. The former United Western officials contend the seizure was an abuse of power and want their bank back. Jackson's ruling means their claim survives its first legal hurdle. First Citizens, which absorbed $2 billion worth of United Western assets and took over the community bank's 8 Denver area branches, is not named as a party in the suit. The First Citizens takeover was announced in July. The outcome of the lawsuit could affect First Citizens, a $21 billion total asset bi-coastal lender. In its recent quarterly report filed with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, First Citizens included a one-paragraph update of the case that took notice of Jackson's ruling. It is unclear what impact, if any, the litigation will have on FCB, First Citizens Bank shares, or the assets acquired in the United Western transaction, the bank stated. First Citizens spokeswoman Barbara Thompson says the Raleigh Bank would have no further statement. First Citizens Bank is not named in this action, and we have no comment, she says. Former state banking regulator Don Coker says he has never heard of a case in which a bank seizure has been reversed. I think that would be a very difficult thing to do, he says, not to mention the fact that the seized bank's reputation has already been destroyed. I'm not sure they could ever get it back if the takeover got reversed. United Western was the 5th of 6 failed bank takeovers performed by First Citizens since 2009. The former executives of the Denver Bank filed their case only weeks after the seizure. Naming both OTS and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which acted as the receiver and brought in First Citizen as the buyer. Attorneys for OTS had asked Jackson to toss out the legal challenge on the procedural grounds that the United Western lawsuit wasn't a formal act of the bank board accompanied by the proper corporate protocol, meeting notices, minutes, and the like. The argument didn't win the judge. While federal statutes fully authorize OTS to decapitate the bank, Jackson wrote in her response, it also grants the severed head one final request to ask to be reattached. It is no defense to complain that the head did not put it in writing. Jackson did dismiss the complaint against the FDIC, but not the OTC. The United Western legal challenge to federal regulators is the first since the financial meltdown of 2008. Shareholder OK seen as a breeze in Duke Progress Union. This article is written by John Downey with the Dateline of Charlotte. Duke Energy Corporation's proposed $13.7 billion purchase of Progress Energy Incorporated appears headed to easy approval in separate shareholder votes on Tuesday in Charlotte and in Raleigh. Tom Surzin, who follows the utility industry as Vice President for Equity Securities at Regulatory Research Associates, says everything he hears from analysts and investors indicates no significant shareholder objections to the merger. Generally speaking, this has been viewed as a logical combination that has a good potential to happen, he says. Tuesday's meetings may be free of the demonstrations and challenges by consumer and environmental advocacy groups that have marked most Duke shareholder meetings in recent years. Charlotte anti-nuclear activist Beth Henry, a Duke shareholder, says she hasn't even decided whether to attend the Duke gathering. In Durham, Jim Warren, executive director of the North Carolina Waste Awareness and Reduction Network, says his organization has no plans to be at either meeting. Instead, Henry says advocacy groups are concentrating on the September hearings on the merger before the North Carolina Utilities Commission. That's where our voices are more likely to be heard, we hope, she says. After the merger was announced in January, it drew early complaints that Progress was selling out too cheap. Duke and Progress acknowledge a utility company they won't name made a higher but unofficial offer just before the deal was announced. Circumstances surrounding the merger make it clear the bid came from Virginia's Dominion Resources. Lawsuits were filed but have since been settled. They allege that Progress's board had failed to get the best deal for shareholders, but the argument that the price is too low does not appear to have gained much traction. Independent proxy advisor firm Glass Lewis & Company, based in San Francisco, called the benefits of the transaction with Duke both clear and compelling in its August 16 edition of Deal Watch. The consideration looks reasonable based on each firm's expected contributions to the combined entity and when compared to similar mergers between electric utilities over the past 6 years, it says. Glass Lewis recommended in early August that Duke and Progress shareholders approve the merger. The nation's other leading proxy advisory company, ISS Proxy Advisory Services, also has recommended that shareholders okay the deal. Votes have been coming in by proxy since early August, Duke CEO Jim Rogers said recently. The results of those proxies won't be known until the votes are tabulated by each company's accounting firm at Tuesday's meetings. But Rogers has expressed confidence in the merger's approval. It is my judgment that it is on track to be completed by the end of the year, he has said. Federal regulators have found no antitrust issues in the Duke Progress deal, and the Federal Communications Commission has given its nod. The state of Kentucky recently granted conditional approval for the deal. That leaves the North Carolina regulatory hearing scheduled September 20 and a final decision from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission expected in October. Ohio, Indiana, and Florida regulators have no role in approving the merger. South Carolina is expected to hold hearings on the eventual combination of the company's local utility subsidiaries, Duke Energy Carolinas and Progress Energy Carolinas, but it has no direct say on the merger of the parent companies. Once Duke and Progress merge, the combined company will face immediate challenges, Surzin says. The biggest from the Progress side will be the repair and restarting of its damaged Crystal River nuclear plant in Florida. Surzin sees the as-yet-unknown expense of those repairs as one reason Progress shareholders are likely to welcome the purchase by Duke, with its deeper pockets. From the Duke side, issues surrounding its operation in partially deregulated Ohio may be the most pressing. As with any merger, there are likely to be culture challenges in melding the companies. But Surzin says Duke and Progress already have similar cultures. One obvious question is whether Rogers, who intends to stay active as the company's executive chairman, can fully cede authority to Progress CEO Bill Johnson, who will be Duke's new chief executive. Only time will tell on that one, Surzin said. But Rogers is in his early 60s, and there is a trend in the industry that it is time for younger blood to come in. Downey is a reporter for the Charlotte Business Journal. Lundy gets financing, breaking ground. That's the headline on the next article, written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with a Dateline of Clayton. The Lundy Group of Raleigh has secured financing to finish site work and infrastructure for its 50-acre Spring Branch Commercial Park in Clayton, and the firm expects to break ground on the first medical office building in September. Jim Baker, president of the Lundy Group, says he and his investors decided to grade the entire site and install most of the roads, water, sewer, and utilities infrastructures before selling any of the lots to prove to potential lot buyers that they are serious about the project and, unlike many these days, have financial backing. Such a strategy was more common when the real estate markets were strong, but since the banking industry crashed, developers have had trouble securing finances for speculative projects. There's a lot of land in that area where people have a lot of great-looking blueprints, but we decided we wanted to pre-grade and move ahead with the project, Baker says. Spring Branch Park is adjacent to Johnston Health's $39 million medical center campus that opened in August 2009. Four Oaks Bank has provided financing for the $4 million already invested in Spring Branch's roads and utilities, Baker says. Capital Bank is financing the construction loan for the $7 million medical office building. About 80% of the 30,000-square-foot building space is pre-leased to a tenant base that includes Raleigh Radiology, University Orthopedics and Sports Medicine, Active Care Physical Therapy, and others. Right now, doctors are the only ones who can borrow any money. That's where the action is, Baker says. So for the near term, medical space is the most popular sector from a bank financing standpoint. Meridian Senior Living of Hickory has contracted with Lundy to buy a 3-acre lot at Spring Branch, where it plans to build a 77-bed assisted living and memory care facility. Meridian plans to break ground on its facility before the end of December, says Hunter Tresgar, a project manager for the company. It will have 48 beds dedicated to patients being treated for Alzheimer's disease or other memory impairment issues, and 28 beds for residents needing assisted living services. Tresgar says the company has been able to accelerate its construction timeline because the Lundy Group had already taken care of much of the infrastructure work for the site. The Spring Branch Master Plan allows for about 500,000 square feet of space for retail, medical, specialty, and office users. When Smithfield-based Johnston Health announced plans to build the medical center in Clayton, town officials hoped the campus would spur commercial and retail development along the NC-42 and US 70 bypass corridor, as well as provide more health care services for Clayton residents. Johnston Medical Center Clayton has its own emergency department, outpatient surgery facilities, and equipment for laboratory and imaging services. It's great that we don't have to go into Wake County for health care services anymore, says Clayton Mayor Jody McLeod. McLeod says Johnston Health is looking at the possibility of turning the Clayton Medical Center into a full-service hospital in the future. I'm excited that the best-kept secret is out that Clayton is a hot spot, says the mayor. And now for our remaining minutes, we turn to the TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here's some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. Cree buys Rudd Lighting for $583 million. Durham's Cree Incorporated is buying Rudd Lighting for $583 million in a cash and stock transaction, the company announced after markets closed Wednesday. The maker of semiconductor chips used in LED and other products issued $211 million in additional stock to complete the acquisition. Wall Street promptly dropped Cree stock by almost 10% in aftermarket trading. The deal includes $85 million in concurrent payments to retire outstanding debt, as well as about $143 million in future tax benefits tied to the purchase. The deal will have a slightly negative impact on earnings through fiscal 2012, but a positive impact on earnings before one-time items are factored in. JetBlue, American Airlines soar on stock market. Airline stocks outclimbed major indexes Monday as investors shrugged off concerns about the economy and focused on the positive prospects for carriers. High flyers included several airlines that serve Raleigh-Durham International Airport, AMR Corporation, Southwest Airlines Company, JetBlue Airways Corporation, Delta Airlines, U.S. Airways Group Incorporated, and United Continental Holdings. By contrast, the S&P 500 index rose 2.2% to 1,204. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 1.9%. Carlyle Group interested in PPD? Pharmaceutical product development is being looked at by Carlyle Group exclusively, anonymous sources told Bloomberg, giving credence to a Wall Street Journal report last month that the Washington-based contract research organization was looking for a sale. PPD Incorporated stock traded at a 52-week high of $33.07 Monday and traded around $32.50 for much of Tuesday morning. The stock rose sharply after the Bloomberg story posted at 10 a.m. and reported that most offers were between $33 and $38 a share, citing the anonymous sources. PPD employs 1,400 workers in the Triangle and has about 11,000 employees in 44 countries. $50 million Cameron Village project now underway. Crescent Resources LLC said Wednesday that construction has started on its gallery at Cameron Village apartment community, located on a 2.6-acre site at Clark Avenue and Herbalin Road. The gallery at Cameron Village will feature 282 apartment homes and 16,000 square feet of retail space. It is the first multifamily development at Cameron Village. The development is slated to open in the spring of 2013. Carrie Social Media firm lands Chrysler looks to hire 40. Ignite Social Media of Carrie has been named the social media agency of record for a large and noteworthy client, Chrysler Group LLC, in a coup that is prompting Ignite to hire as many as 40 employees. Though based in Cary, Ignite also maintains an office in Birmingham, Michigan. The agency, helmed by Jim Tobin, has a client roster that includes Microsoft, Nike, Quintiles, and Samsung. On Ignite's website, Tobin blogs that the firm is rapidly filling some 40-plus positions across account service, metrics monitoring, community management engagement, art direction, copywriting, web development programming, and more. And we'll read a tiny bit of this last article, headlined, Williams Mullen Launches Appeals Practice in Raleigh. And this is written by Chris Bagley with the Dateline of Raleigh. Richmond-based Williams Mullen has created a practice group in its Raleigh office for appellate litigation and hired two attorneys with U.S. Supreme Court experience, a move that raises the firm's profile and potentially its profit. And we'll stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until next time.